This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
There's something wrong with that, whatchamacallit, the arm inside that thing, and it makes the tank take a real long time to fill up, you know?
Oh, I see.
You better have some reading ahead of you now, man.
I got something to do here, huh? Man, this is crazy.
Have you heard anything about philosophy?
Well, I...
What have you read, actually?
I'll tell you what I've read. You know these books that they put out, the books, this made simple, that made simple, law made simple.
Oh, yeah. So,
Well, they got one called Philosophy Made Simple. Well, I read that. And, well, that's the only thing I actually read all the way through. And I bought a few books, those things, something I picked up called Language, Truth, Logic. You know, like stuff like that. Just picked up on something I get into, man, and I don't get any further than the first few pages, you know, and then I start looking around and try to find things.
What do you think you're looking for? You're interested in philosophy? I mean,
I don't know. That's what I mean, I don't think it's really that I'm looking for as an end, you know. But it seems to be something in it that I'm kind of late, you know. I guess it's just for seeing what I finally decided that it would be a good idea to see what other people thought about it. You know, it makes people think better than I did, you know. See what they think about living. Just, you know, it's like.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you think about living in life up to this point?
Well, I couldn't give you an answer. I couldn't. I don't have it together. Well, man, you know, I don't think I have. I couldn't say.
Do you think there seems to be an overall plan to the thing, and do you think it is that your life is predetermined, or that you're your own free agent and you make what you want of your life?
Well, it seems like I make. I believe when you say that you make almost what you want, but in a way you do. But like Quinn, it seems like part you don't have much to do with.
Much control over.
Yeah, like Quinn is when you know you kind of set your course, but when you arrive and things like that, you know. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always happen as you plan. You know, you don't know that's
sure
somewhere else. You know, you can kind of set it.
Before you got interested in philosophy and
well, I'll tell you.
Starting to think about philosophy, what did you...
I can say.
Yeah.
It started with religion, I guess. Well, taught from childhood, you know, religion. And then the first question of religion, that brought on everything. You know, when I got to the age where I would start to wonder about things.
Mm-hmm. What faith were you brought up in, Joe?
Methodist.
Did you have a very strict religious life, or was it better?
Well, it wasn't too strict, but it was there. I mean, like my grandfather, both of my grandfathers were ministers. And my mother, she was very religious. But, like, in my early years, well, she went to church every Sunday and stuff like that. Being under the influence of her grandfather, he was the dominating character in the family. Actually, he was the most, well-versed, I guess, politically. He was most active, you know, than my father was a tailor, but he never seemed to say too much. You know, just went about his business, that was it, you know. But my grandfather, he was pretty militant, you know. politically inclined in religion, which is fear, you know. So that's where I grew up in it. And I guess I just accepted it, and I thought I felt certain things. And then I said, late teens, I started breaking away, you know, and lost certain things. Just growing up, so I questioned, you know, a lot of how I found in religion. I began to wonder about it. But 2 or 3 years later, maybe 22, 23, this Muslim thing, I got introduced to that, you know, and that kind of shook me. I had a lot of my friends, they weren't Muslim, I would say. So I thought about that. Anyway, it took me to something I never thought about, you know, another religion, you know. So that started me to think. But I never did anything, but I just thought about it, you know. Shit, I was too busy with another thing. And I forgot it. I think I put it out of my mind for several years. I didn't bother to think about it. And recently I started looking into, you know, I said, well, maybe I can just see what people are thinking, you know, because I realize that's what I'm trying to do, you know. That's why I started, I turned to things like this, you know. I haven't devoted as much time to it as I want to. I haven't actually learned or covered as much ground in it as I'd like to. I'd like to cover more ground, but I'd like to, you know, like get my own thoughts together, composed the way I feel like they should be, you know. I was like religion, man. I was disappointed when I found out how many religions there were and how.
You were disappointed?
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
I was not disappointed. I don't know what they. When I saw there were so many religions and how opposed some were to the next and so forth, you know, I threw up my hand. And I don't know. I was kind of confused. I just couldn't believe that every one guy could be right, and of course he's right, somebody else got to be wrong, you know, if he is right, and all vice versa, you know.
Well, if there's any kind of a chance of all the religions that there are actually being tied in with one another, and by that I mean regardless of what they say or what they think, that the basic things that are involved in their religions are all actually tied in with the basic things that the next guy believes and the next guy believes and so on down the line. And that through history, through time, and through people acting on religions, they have tried to say, well, what I've got is right and what you've got is wrong because you call yourself this and I call myself that. And that the people have actually changed the face of religion, so to speak, but the basic things involved are all pretty much the same.
Sure, I think the basic things would bring them all together, man, if it was just, if there was anybody to say, well, get together.
In other words, then you would like to see something like a universal type religion where instead of there being all these differences and one guy knocking the next because he's belongs to a different faith.
It should be something like this.
If there is something basic to all of them, then they should all get together.
Yeah, it should be. I think so. It should be that way. But like when you study, like you see what these people say about good, you know, philosophers, when they start talking about good and bad, man, they take those two words and go so far with them. And, it could be a complicated thing.
Well, I think.
But it's got to be simple. I mean, really, to really get some good out of it, to really realize something, you got to make it simple. And I think religion, they pretty well, they've got it made if they can get together. Because I don't, when they say what they preach is good, I mean, it seems good to me.
Do you think that when you finish reading a certain number of books and have had time to absorb and think these things over, that it will change you in any way or change your outlook on life in any way?
Well, I don't think it'll change me. I think it'll help me to understand, you know, like I'll be able to walk a little surer, you know, I'll be, just take a little confusion away, you know, I think I'll be the same.
Do you think very many musicians are more than confused, just like everybody might be, about this religious business, that they might be interested in it in the same way that you might be interested in it, by trying to gain a little bit more understanding of just what's going on? And do you think a lot of them fall into that category? Have you ever talked with any other musicians about it?
Yeah, well, I think the majority of musicians are interested in truth. You know, they've got to be, because a musical thing is a truth. If you play make a musical statement, and it's a valid statement, that's a truth right there in itself, you know. And if you play something phony, well, you know that's phony, you know. And all musicians are striving for that near perfection that they can get, mm-hmm. You know, that's truth there, you know. And so, in order to play those kind of things, play truth, you've got to live with as much truth as you possibly can, you know. And that's one of that religious, if a guy is religious, and I think if he's searching for good, he wants to live a good life. He might call it religious, or he might not call himself religious. Maybe he says, I just live a good life. But a religious man would call him, he said, well, that man is a religious man, he lives a good life. So, yeah, quite a few musicians think about it. I've talked with quite a few of them about it.
Are there any that stand out in your mind as having views that you feel are closer to the truth than other fellows might have? Are there any musicians that you respect because of their views in this line?
Well, no, not offhand. I can't think of anyone more than others. You know, I've talked to quite a few, and they all seem to be searching, trying to find some way. You know, most musicians I know. And some don't talk about it at all, you know. They seem to be pretty well contained. Maybe they've found, you know, just what they want, you know. I don't know.
It's a long subject to try to get into, I know.
Yeah, I get wound up in it, man. You know, I get confused, and then I have to forget about it for a while.
Changing the subject a little bit, in your playing and listening experiences in the past few years, who do you feel are the musicians today that you respect most? That's putting you really on the spot, I realize, but I'm sure that Monk must fall into a category like this, because last night you were quite positive about the fact that he was a real major contributor and a great writer and really had something to offer the people. What other musicians fall into this category?
Well, I'll name some that I like, and I might be leaving out quite a few. You
that
know?
Always happens.
Yeah, there might be quite a few I'm leaving out. Hart Silver, for one. And all the great solos, you know, like Miles and Sonny Rollins. Guys like that. But when I like or mention a guy like Monk, he's to me, he's a soloist, and he's got, you know, well, he writes so many things, you know. And there are just few like him, really, you know, like Charlie Parker was like that. He could play, and he could write quite a few things, you know. Dizzy, he writes quite a bit, too.
Benny Golson,
he's another contributor. Quincy. G.G. Grice, too. And there's a guy plays, he's in the Army right now, plays tenor, named Wayne Shorter. I think he's going to contribute quite a bit, too. Because he has this, double talent. He can play, you know, and then he's got enough stuff to play a whole lot and then sit down and write a lot too, you know.
What do you think of Johnny Hodges and of Lester Young today?
I like him just as well.
Yeah,
as I did.
As well as you used to.
Yeah, just as well as I did 15 years ago.
Well, Rabbit certainly was—he'd have to put him in the front ranks, really, of any group of musicians that you name, because he always played so prettily, man. He was always a beautiful player. I know Bird. I remember reading an interview with Bird in a magazine one time, and Bird was very, very enthusiastic about Hodges' playing, and said that. Hodges was one of his major influences.
Yeah, he was great.
And so much soul.
So much soul, man. A lot of soul.
A lot of people say that Lester doesn't play as well today as he used to. I don't know. To me, he's always played great.
I think so, too.
He's always played great. He always gets a great sound. He's always got young guys with him, too. You notice nowadays, well, for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. He's always chosen some of what he felt were the younger talents, like this trumpet player that he had working with him for quite a while, Jesse Drake.
Yeah. He's a very good trumpeter.
He's a very, very good trumpeter. The trouble is you don't hear enough of him.
That's right. I don't know why. But he'll be heard. He's a good trumpeter. Yeah. He'll find some groove somewhere for him.
Well, when you first started with Monk, before you actually went to work at the Five Stack, did Monk used to hold rehearsals so that you could learn all the tunes and?
Yes. Yeah.
How did these things go? I'm kind of curious as to how he more or less made you familiar with the tunes he was doing, the changes. And
well, I'd go by his house, you know, by his apartment, and get him out of bed, maybe, or something. And then he'd wake up and load the piano and start playing, you know. He'd play anything. It might be just one of his tunes, you know. He'd start playing it, and he'd look at me, I guess. And so when he'd look at me, I'd get my arm, you know, and start trying to find what he was playing. And continue to play over and over and over and over, and I get this part, and then next time we go over it, I get another part, and he would stop and show me some parts that were pretty difficult, and if I had a lot of trouble, well, he'd get his portfolio out, you know, and I'd show him the music. He's got music, he's got all of them written, and I read it, and none of it. He would rather a guy learn without reading, you know, because that way you feel it better, you feel it quicker. When you memorize it, when you learn it by heart, by ear, you know. And so when I almost had the tune down, then he would leave me with it. You know, he'd leave me to practice it alone. And he'd go out somewhere, maybe go to the store, go back to bed or something. Mm-hmm. And I'd just sit there and run over it, so I had it pretty well. And then I'd call him and we'd play it down together. And sometimes we'd just get one tune a day. Yeah.
How long did it take you before you actually felt you were ready to go down to find a spot and actually work as a regular unit, you know?
Well, as soon as you got the job at the fire spot, we went right in, because just going over things that started earlier, I met him, you know, and I just started hanging around with him, you know. I went down and started going down his house because I like that music, you know. And we'd already recorded one song, Monk's Mood, yeah.
That was the one that you moved from Philly just to do.
Yeah, I liked it so well, you know, I told him that I wanted to learn it, so he invited me around, you know. That's when I started learning this tune. We didn't know if we would ever work together. Really enjoyed it, too. I sure enjoyed working with Monk.
You think that was a turning point, really, in your playing career?
Well, I don't know whether it was a turning point. About that time, I made a decision, you know, like that, myself. That's when I stopped drinking and all that stuff. And I was able to play better right then, you know.
Did you used to drink heavily?
Yeah. So by the time that he started the group, I stopped drinking, you know. That helped me in all kinds of ways when I started drinking. I could play better, sing better, everything. And his music was, I was stimulant.
How did you used to feel when you were working on the fire spot when, I know we had seen you a couple of times down there, in the middle of a tune, Monk would get up from the piano and walk around on the side of it and do his little thing, and leave you standing there more or less holding the bag.
I feel kind of lonesome, man. I felt a little lonesome up there.
Well, when you're standing up there playing like that, how do you hear the changes? Do you think of the changes as you're going along, or does the bass player suggest them to you with what he's playing? Or?
Yeah, the bass player, I count on him, you know.
What does he actually do? Like when Wilbur would be playing bass, would he play like the dominant note in each chord? I don't know how you phrase this, but can you explain it?
Well, at times, but a bass player like Wilbur Ware, he's so inventive, man, you know, like he doesn't always play the dominant notes.
But whatever he plays is a suggestive note that gives you an idea of which way the changes are going.
Yeah, it may be. Yeah. It might not be. But Wilbur, he plays the other way sometimes. He plays things that are rather kind of, you know, they're foreign. Mm-hmm. Well, if you didn't know the song, well, you wouldn't be able to find it, you know, because he's superimposing things. He's playing around or under or over or something, you know, building tension. Mm-hmm. So that when he comes back to it, you know, you feel everything sucks in.
Yeah.
But usually I knew the tune, so I mean, it was alright. I knew the changes anyway, so we managed to come out to the end together anyway.
Which always helps.
Yeah, we managed to finish on time. Yeah. A lot of fun playing that way, though.
I can imagine it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So sometimes he would be playing altered changes, and I would be playing altered changes. Yeah. And he would be playing some other kind of altered changes from the type I'd be playing. And neither one of us playing the changes of the tune until we reach a certain spot, you know, and then if we get there together, we're lucky, you know, that's. And then Monk comes back in to save everybody. And nobody knows where he is. That's the impression a lot of people got anyway. You know, they said, man, how do you guys remember all that stuff? You know, we weren't really remembering much. Just the basic changes and
and everybody else just tried anything he wanted to try on it. So. And Monk, he's always doing something back there that sounds so mysterious. And it's not mysterious at all, you know, when you know what he's doing. Just like those little things, just like simple truth, you know, like he just, he might take a chord, a major chord, a minor chord, and leave the third out. But yet he says, this is a minor chord, man, you know. So you don't have a minor third in there, so you don't know what it is. You say, well, how do you know it's a minor chord? Well, that's what it is, a minor chord with the third out. Well, he feels that way, so there you go. And when he plays the thing, man, it will just be in the right place and voice the right way to have that minor feel. But still, it's not a minor because it's no third, it's not there. It's little things like that, you know.
Well, did he pull that on you actually working on the job? Or had he done this before, previously, with you, where he'd gotten up and left the piano and left you, so to speak, holding the bag?
Well, he just started that on the job.
He just started on the job? How did you feel about that when he first did it?
Well, I started looking around for him the first time he did it, but after that I got used to it, you know, and I just tried to hold up till he got back.
Why do you think he did it?
I don't know. He said he wanted to hear it, and he said he wanted to hear the band. Like when he did that, he was an audience himself, and he was listening to the band. And then he come back, you know, he got something out of that thing. Man.
I used to get the biggest kick out of the way he'd do this little shuffle dance on the side, you know?
Yeah, I wanted to see that myself, you know? I couldn't see.
Did it ever occur to you to pull your horn away from your mouth and walk over and stand behind him and let him throw me off? And then Wilbur and Shadow did it.
Yeah, I should have done it, man. I wanted to see it myself. Like, it was so interesting. Everybody was talking about it. And every once in a while, I'd open up one eye and peep at it, you know. He was really enjoying it, you know. That's, he was getting a big kick then.
I'm sure that he must have really enjoyed your playing, I know, because...
Well, he said he did. Anyway, you know.
I spoke to him once or twice, I know, and... Each time he'd say, well, yeah, he's the man.
It's, I learned a lot with him. Learned, like, little things, you know, I learned to watch little things. I don't know, he's just a good musician, man, you know, it's like, if you work with a guy who watches the finer points of things, you know, it kind of helps you a little bit to try to watch the finer points sometimes. And little things mean so much in music, like everything else, you know? Like the way you build a house, starting with those little things, you get the little things together and then the whole structure will stand up. If you goof the little things, you don't have...
Same kind of a playing experience, playing, say, with Miles now as it was with Monk?
No, it's altogether a different thing. I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's just another great experience, you know.
But it was slightly a different nature, though.
Yes, it's slightly different. And I can't quite explain the difference either, you know.
Who had you worked with before you worked with Miles when he had the Red and Paul and Philly Joe? And who had you been with before that?
Well, you want the whole string of?
If you feel like saying it.
So, man, let's see.
I know one thing is for sure and certain. You worked with an awful lot of people.
Yeah, I did.
And it spread out over a pretty good span of time.
Yeah.
Well, like say for example, like you said, 14 years ago, 44 was when you first started playing.
Yeah.
When did you have your first professional gig with anybody?
Well, I usually call my first professional job with a band from Indianapolis, led by Joe Webb. And this was in 47.
Ray?
He's downstairs. Ray!
All right, I'll take it downstairs.
All right.
Hold up. Big Maybell was in this band, you know, Big Maybell blues. This was, I don't know what the heck we were, rhythm and blues or everything. I don't know what that meant. Anyway, that's, that band and King Kolax, you heard of Kolax, eh? Trumpet. And Eddie Vincent. Dizzy. Earl Bostic. Gay Cross.
Who?
Gay Cross.
I'm not
familiar. He's from Cleveland. He had a little band. He used to be with Lil' Jordan one time in his band. He had a little band that was patterned after Lil' Jay. He sang and played something like Lil'. And Daisy Mae and the Hepcats. Johnny Hodges.
You did work with Hodges?
Yeah.
When was this?
In 1953.
For how long?
Six, 7 months, I think.
Really? Who else was in the band?
Well, we had Richard Powell on piano, and Lawrence Brown, Emmett Berry, Edward Trubley, the boy, and a guy named Jimmy Johnson on drums. Basically, I forgot his name.
That surprises me. I had no idea that you ever worked with Hodgson. Yeah?
Sure, man.
I mean, that was a real gas for you, wasn't it?
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I enjoyed it. Yeah, they had some true music, you know. Man. Lawrence Brown, I like him immensely, man.
How'd you feel it? No, you have never.
Great trombonist, you know?
Oh, yeah. Not
MVP. Emmett Berry, he impressed me too. Johnny Hodges, I feel like it. And Earl Bostic is kind of tremendous too. I didn't appreciate guys men like Earl and after I heard Charlie Clark, you know, because Charlie, you know, he swayed me so much, you know. But after I come out from under it a little bit, you know, after I'd been under it a little bit, under his spell, then I could kind of listen to other people, too. You know, when I played with these men, like, that's where I learned a lot from. The main thing was trying to just see how things were, you know, see how you have a guy here who plays all together different, you know, you say, well, that's so-and-so, I know him anyway. Then you hear something else, say, well, that's so-and-so, I know him anyway. And then you sit down and maybe you can try to see where they both came from, you know, and you find maybe they came out of the same tree somewhere along the line. And, you know, so when I start looking at jazz like that too, you know, at it collectively, looking at the whole thing. And then after Johnny Hodges, it was Miles, that was the next one. I worked with Jimmy Smith for about a couple of weeks before I went with Miles, the organist.
Yeah, he's tremendous.
Wow. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, man, hearing that organ. Yeah, man, it was called screaming at me.
You don't work with Bud Powell?
Well, I played with Bud. I never worked with him. I think I played one gig with him. Back in 1949, Miles used to get with dance jobs in the Audubon in New York, uptown, way up on Broadway. And I think on one of the jobs she had Sonny Rollins and Bud, Art Blakely, I forgot the bass man and myself, you know, on this dance job. I think that's the only time I worked with Bud. He was playing too. Sonny Rollins, you heard him recently?
Well, the last time I heard him, let's see, was in November.
Yeah.
Last November. And of course, the LP that he made up at the Night at the Village Vanguard with Alvin Jones and I forget who the bass player now was. I know Donald Bailey from Baltimore here was on one cut. And I think he had Wendell Marshall with him. At the concert that I saw him.
Yeah, like some guys, you know, you call great, man. And Sonny, he's one. Like a, you know, talent that should have lasted. What's going on, you know, because he just reached that great status, man.
What do you think of tenor players like, say, Bill Perkins and Richie Kamuka, the fellows that fall into the so-called, it's a bad word, but the so-called West Coast school?
Well, I haven't heard them enough to actually pass comment. You know, I couldn't say. Ricky I know very well, because we came up in Philly together. He always could play, you know. But I haven't heard him, man, since he was with Kenton. I didn't hear him once then, you know. I didn't hear him, like, stretch out and say he just played a few solos with the band. I'll say that I like his style, you know. And Perkins, I'm not too familiar with what he's doing. I haven't heard of any of his LPs or records yet. What style does he play like most?
Well, it seems to be out of the Lesters.
Lester.
Kick, a little bit of Stan Getz, a little bit of The Sims, a little bit of Herbie Stewart, in that general vein that's all derived from Lester.
Yeah.
He seems to have a little bit more of an individual voice than some of the other guys.
Does he play any Bird?
No, I don't think so. It's a different kind of listening experience than listening to somebody like yourself.
Or Sonny.
Sonny or any of the really good tenor players on this side of the country.
Well, I'm sure they're good, you know.
They're all very, very competent.
Yeah, I'm sure they're good.
That I wonder about, though, is that when you listen to something on LP by them, because here again, I've been forced into the same position as you have, I haven't really had a chance to hear them in person, you know. And I have heard a few LPs, though. But what I've heard seems to have been very well thought out. But when it comes to the solos, it's like the whole thing is very well preconceived, so that you don't have the spontaneousness, if you can call it that. It doesn't seem to be a thing of the moment that happens. It seems to me that whoever the soloist is, he's thought the whole thing out, and he knows just what he's going to play before he ever plays it. And he's eliminated any mistakes that he might have made. Like, you remember on the Mug thing? That, I forget which tune it was in that LP that you did with Hawkins and them?
Yeah.
Where you had forgotten to come in and Mug just shouting, Coltrane, Coltrane.
Yeah.
And then they let the thing go, you know? Well, that's the kind of a thing, to my way of thinking, that makes great music. Where you catch mistakes as well as you catch great moments, you know?
And even Hawkins. Hawkins came in wrong on that thing, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I couldn't advise that doing that too many times, too often.
No, but, I mean, that's just, that's an example.
That was very spontaneous, brother.
I guess you were so wrapped up with what he was doing.
Yeah, well, see, when we made that, I hadn't played with him too long. I hadn't been playing with him long. And actually, he would throw me more, you know, quite often. He would actually throw me because I hadn't played with him long then. And I was unfamiliar, you know, with the changes and stuff. But as time went by, I got used to him, you know, and he can get awfully tricky, you know. It makes you keep alert, you see. He likes that, you know. He likes to keep the mental process vibrating, you know. And you get to like that thing, you know, after you get to play with it a while. But at first, he's like, I was afraid.
He wouldn't leave here about 6, so you get back over there at 7.
Well, that's what I was worried about. I just happened to look. I asked Shelby what time it was. I was checking my clock, and it's 6 o'clock.
It is 6 o'clock already.
Well, I'm way back.
Yes, yeah. It is.
Can you wait just about 2 minutes and let me drive over with you so I can wake up?
All right, sure. Hurry up now. Because I want to get over there about 7 now.
Yeah, I was doing all right. This is all. I was doing all right until I didn't think it was on this way.
But what I thought I'd do is with this thing, I could take it down to the clubhouse, you know. And the next meeting, I play it back, you know, for the rest of the club members. I'm sure they'd get a big kick out of hearing the thing, and certainly would illuminate them.
Well,
more aspects of you than they had probably thought about before, you know.
Maybe so, yeah.
And then the other
I wish I had something constructive to say, you know, something.
You got something constructive
something
to say.
Something fine to say, but I'll just end up like everybody saying, keep swinging or something like that.
Now, I'll tell you, another thing I had in my mind as this thing was going on, and you were talking quite naturally about different things, I got to thinking that I might just, if it's okay with you, I might just sit down and try to go back over, just play this tape over for myself, and try to write the thing out and send it into Downbeat and see if they wouldn't print a feature article on you. Because God knows they have a good one on you, man.
They printed any number of your things. It might be true.
Well, they haven't printed any number of things.
They printed several
of them. Well, the only thing that they were printed was the article on the club here. And that was Metronome.
Metronome.
Yeah, and that, I was never paid for that. I didn't want you paid necessarily. But,
well, I like to have something, you know, to really say, like maybe after I search around a little bit, maybe I can find something real concrete to hash over with, you know, about jazz, something like that. And then we can talk it up, maybe. If you like to send it in, it'd be all right with me. Oh, just if you... You wanna?
Well,
just let me see the thing. Let me see it.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll try to write it up and let me have your address, man. You know.
Okay.
And let me write it up and I'll mail you the original. And if you think it's okay, why? You can go ahead, man. Because I don't think I have your address, though.
No, because
here
we didn't have any Christmas time. We couldn't send him a Christmas.
That's right.
We sent him one down to the 5-spot, remember?
Did you ever get
it? I think I got it, too.
Huh? We sent one to you down to, that's right.
At the 5-spot.
It wasn't to him, though. It was to the whole group.
No, it was to him.
It was to the
and
whole
we
group.
Contemplated sending one to Monk, and we said, nah, Monk wouldn't remember this anyway.
Well, he might have. I don't know.
I didn't. Monk's in the world all by himself.
What?
He's the one was at the whole school.
The world's fastest dresser.
The world's fastest dresser.
She's not quite dressed. Not dressed. When you got your hair tied up and all that stuff.
The Jews on here, the chair out here. Yeah, where is it?
This is in Philly, right?
No.
Oh, this is in New York?
I slept all the way home last night.
Yeah, I guess you didn't.
I went to sleep shortly after Washington. And woke up just as we come in Baltimore. I had a big crick or pain in my neck. I wouldn't have awakened then, but I saw the car stop.
Get an itching in my ear, man. It made me shiver.